Hello everyone, and welcome back to the History of Scotland podcast, episode 42. I'm Fraser, and it's a privilege to once again guide you through the rich and intricate tapestry of Scotland's past. In our last episode, we delved into the 12th and 13th centuries, a pivotal era for Scottish military tactics. We explored the intricacies of warfare during these tumultuous times, examining the tactics employed, the impact on Scotland's rugged terrain, and how these strategies evolved over the time, and also how the Scots adapted to the challenges of medieval warfare, especially with the changing times of the Norman conquest. The episode painted a vivid picture of a nation honing its martial skills in the face of both domestic and foreign challenges. Today, we turn the pages of history to the early to mid-reign of our next and great ruler, Malcolm IV, known as Malcolm the Maiden. As the grandson of the revered David I, a king who was certainly my favourite, Malcolm IV had a monumental legacy to live up to, not only just for me, but for you guys as well, I hope, and for the contemporaries during his time. His grandfather's reign was marked by profound transformation and growth as we know. It left an indelible mark on Scotland's history. The question is, and the question we'll answer today when we explore, is whether Malcolm IV could carry this forward. Could he carry the legacy and etch his own mark on the annals of Scottish history? Malcolm IV's reign is a fascinating period, filled with its own unique challenges and triumphs. We'll embark on a journey through his ascension to the throne, a time coloured by youthful ambition and the weight of legacy. We'll explore the internal and external forces that shaped his reign, from domestic policies and governance to the intricacies of foreign relations and diplomacy. As we unpack Malcolm's reign, we'll delve into the crucial military campaigns and conflict that defined his time as king during his early time. We'll also touch upon his relationship with the church and how the religious influence played into his governance. And of course, we'll shed light on Malcolm IV's personal life, his health, and the character traits that defined his leadership. Now, we won't touch upon any romance in today's episode. We'll probably just touch more on his personal health. And then in the next episode, we can discuss whether he did have kids and how that went. In recounting Malcolm IV's story, we'll revisit some familiar chapters of Scotland's history, offering not only a refresher, but also new insights and perspective. So, let's journey back to the 12th century and discover the life and reign of Malcolm IV. Can he live up to the illustrious legacy of David I? Let's find out. In the year 1153 AD, the Scottish monarchy witnessed a pivotal transition with the ascension of Malcolm IV, a moment that was as much about continuing a legacy as it was about embarking on a new path. Born in between the 23rd of April to the 24th of May 1141, Malcolm was just 12 years old when he succeeded his grandfather, David I, a ruler whose reign had profoundly reshaped Scotland. This succession brought to the throne a young monarch, stepping into the shadow of a king who had significantly expanded the nation's power and influence. Malcolm's father, as we know, Henry, Earl of Huntingdon, had predeceased David I in 1152, a year pivotal in shaping the young prince's future. Henry's death altered the line of succession, thrusting Malcolm, his eldest son, into the forefront of Scottish politics. The early loss of his father meant Malcolm was deprived of a period of mentorship that might have prepared him for the complexities of kingship. Both he and William, soon to be William the Lion, our later king, were thrusted into a life without a father. But David I took on that father figure well and became that role model for the short period that he had left in his life. The year 1153, therefore, was not just about a change in leadership, but also about challenges of a boy king navigating the legacy of one of Scotland's most impactful rulers. David I's reign, lasting from 1124 to 1153, was marked by substantial reforms, economic development, and significant expansion of royal power, as we touched upon in our 6 episodes covering him. Malcolm inheriting the throne was faced with the colossal task of sustaining and building upon these achievements. Malcolm's youth and inexperience were evident in the early years of his reign, navigating the intricacies of government, managing the ambitions of Scottish nobility and maintaining the kingdom's stability were formidable tasks for a young king. His reliance on advisers, notably Donnchad, Mormor of Fife, was a necessity. Donnchad, a figure of significant influence and power, was instrumental in supporting Malcolm's rule. If you remember, David appointed Donnchad as his regent, and Donnchad and Malcolm IV went on a tour of the realm and made sure all rulers of the land, so the lords and the nobility, came and submitted to Malcolm before David's passing. And because Donnchad was there, Donnchad was behind Malcolm IV the entire time, he made sure everyone was aware Donnchad, Mormor of Fife, was the senior magnate in the land. However, the reliance also meant that Malcolm's decisions and actions were often viewed through the lens of his advisors like Donnchad, and these ambitions and motivations altered during his reign. But the early part of Malcolm's reign, therefore, was a period of learning and adaptation. It was a time when the young king had to rapidly acclimatise to the demands of ruling a kingdom that was still considering the gains of his grandfather's expansive policies. Now, Malcolm, he will have been crowned at Scone in the traditional manner, following David's exact routine of being crowned king. I did actually want to go over the crowning ceremony and how that looked, but I think I'm going to save that for a separate episode. We'll probably do it for William the Lion, our next king, who's actually going to be one of Scotland's longest rulers. And I think there we can proper touch upon and delve into deep detail on the crowning of the king, because I believe, even though we touched upon it with David the First, William the Lion's life is a lot more documented than Malcolm IV. But let's just be aware that Malcolm IV has been crowned, Donnchad was there, and if you need a bit of prelude to this, a bit more information, do listen to our final episode on David the First, Greater Than Life, where we touch upon Malcolm IV and Donnchad on their tour of the kingdom, and then them being crowned at Scone before, and this is crucial, before David the First was buried. Donnchad made sure Malcolm IV was crowned at Scone before David was buried. Once Malcolm IV was crowned Malcolm IV, David I could finally be buried as one of the greatest kings Scotland had ever seen. But anyway, the early reign for Malcolm, we know it was crucial. It was the testing point of his rule. He either succeeded in the first few months or he'd be overthrown, just like our many past Scottish and Alban kings. So Malcolm's ascension in 1153 set the stage for a reign that would navigate the complexities of the new medieval Scotland, balancing the legacy of his grandfather with realities of his own youthful leadership, which is also a reason why he was crowned before David I was buried, allowing Malcolm to be, you know, recognised as king before everyone forgot about David. In the backdrop of Malcolm IV's early reign, the role of Donnchad, Mormor of Fife, stands out as a significant influence during a period marked by youthful monarchy and political manoeuvring. Donnchad's regency and involvement in the governance during Malcolm's initial years as king were critical in shaping the course of Malcolm's reign. At the outset, Donnchad's role was that of a guide and a protector of the young king's interest. His experience and political acumen were invaluable assets for Malcolm, who was thrust into kingship at a tender age. Donnchad's stewardship was crucial in maintaining stability within the kingdom, especially in handling the Scottish nobility, many of whom might have viewed Malcolm's youth as an opportunity for their ambitions. Donnchad was behind the tour to get Malcolm acquainted with this nobility before David's passing, and he was also behind the decision to not bury David until Malcolm was crowned. So this shows how giant of a figure Donnchad was. However, the nature of Donnchad's influence was complex. While he was a supporter and advisor, the extent of his control over the young king's decisions raised questions about the real power dynamics at play. It was a delicate balancing act, ensuring the king's authority was upheld while also making critical decisions that may have gone beyond the role of as an advisor. This intricate relationship highlighted the challenges inherent in medieval regencies, where the line between guidance and governance often was blurred. As Malcolm matured and became more confident in his role, the relationship with Donnchad evolved. Historical accounts suggest a gradual shift from reliance to a desire for autonomy in decision making. This change was indicative of Malcolm's growing assertiveness as a ruler and his intention to be more than a normal king under the stewardship of an advisor. The fate of Donnchad, Mormorfeith, and how he was viewed during Malcolm's reign are topics that delve into the nuanced and often turbulent world of medieval Scottish politics. Donnchad, despite his initial position of power and influence, faced the inevitable challenge of adapting to the changing dynamics as Malcolm IV grew into his role as a king. This period marked a transition not just for Malcolm, but also for Donnchad, as the young king's increasing desire for independence impacted Donnchad's role and standing in the Scottish court. The fate of Donnchad, though, during Malcolm's reign is a subject that blends historical record with the complexity of medieval Scottish politics. As a pivotal figure during the early years of Malcolm's rule, Donnchad's influence and power was substantial. However, as Malcolm grew into his kingship and sought to assert his authority, the dynamics within the Scottish court evolved. The later years of Donnchad's life and his role in Scottish politics post-regency are less prominently recorded. However, it is generally understood he continued to be a noble of significance, albeit with a reduced role compared to the height of his power during Malcolm's early reign. Donnchad's legacy is intertwined with his stewardship during Malcolm's early years. He is often remembered for his role in the Tor, getting him crowned properly without any significant upheaval, and also making sure his respect of the grandfather of David and the grandson being Malcolm was upheld. The exact circumstances of Donnchad's end, however, including the date and manner of his death, are not detailed extensively in the records. His contribution, however, remains a notable part of the narrative of Malcolm's reign and the broader history of medieval Scotland. Malcolm navigated a complex of web and domestic challenges with rivals and neighbours posing significant threats to his rule. As always with Scottish politics, it was never going to be a simple transition, even if this man was the grandson of the great David I. Understanding the intricacies of these relationships is key to comprehending the political landscape of Scotland during his reign. The Orkney saga recounts William the Noble, son of William Fitzdunker, as a favoured contender for the Scottish throne. Married to Alice de Rumley around 1137 AD, young William was only a child or youth by 1153, making any direct claim to the throne unlikely during Malcolm's early reign. Tragically, however, William's life was cut short in the early years. Other potential claimants included Bishop Wenmode of William Fitzdunker's sons, who had been incapacitated and imprisoned before David I's death, and Donald MacAlpin, the guy who was considered a massive support threshold in Moray, who had a massive support base. And then finally, yes, he's back, Malcolm MacAlexander, the illegitimate son of Alexander I. He'd been imprisoned at Roxburgh since around 1130, but his sons remained free and posed a potential challenge to Malcolm's rule. Oh boy, does David I turn in his grave at hearing that, I bet. Malcolm's position was further complicated by neighbouring rulers like Somled, King of Argyll, Fergus, Lord of Galloway. They were both formidable leaders in their own right, and their ambitions could potentially clash with Malcolm's interests. Another significant figure was, of course, the King of England, Henry II, whose powerful realm and ambitions were a constant consideration for Malcolm, especially after, you know, David's failed invasion, the complexities with the De Bruce family turning to the English. There's a lot of balance acts that he needs to get a hold of with the nobility, especially when a lot of the Norman nobility that David has brought into the Scottish court have land on both sides of the border. In Orkney, the ruler there was initially preoccupied with a pilgrimage, but after his death in 1158, Harold Maddison was brought to power, adding another dimension to the regional power dynamics. Challenged from Malcolm MacAlexander's sons in 1153 November, Malcolm was awoken to first face this open opposition from the sons of Malcolm MacAlexander, who sought the Lord of Argyll's support. However, this threat soon waned as Somerled, the Lord of Argyll, became preoccupied with his own conflicts, including a war with the King of the Isles and potential disputes over Carlisle. The threat to Malcolm's reign was not just external. The internal conspiracies were afoot, with at least two conspirators named by chroniclers, one of whom met his end in a trial by combat in February 1154. By 1157, a notable shift occurred as Malcolm reconciled with Malcolm MacHeath, appointing him to be the Mormondom of Ross, a title likely held by his father. This move was indicative of Malcolm's strategy to stabilise his reign through reconciliation and strategic appointments. So rather than giving Ross to a Norman lord, he gave it to a native Scot rather than an alien. And no, I don't mean green alien, I mean Norman alien. This move, as we know, was trusting. This gave Malcolm MacHeath a trust in Malcolm IV's rule, and Malcolm IV could trust the Mormondom of Ross would not be a place of rebellion like it has been in the past. In the midst of navigating through a landscape riddled with the internal and external challenges, Malcolm's approach to the domestic politics and governance was pivotal in defining his reign. His strategies in dealing with this, with the Scottish nobility like we saw with the Mormondom of Ross, was addressing feudal obligations and implementing reforms, which were crucial in maintaining the stability and continuity of his rule, but also his grandfather's rule. The domestic policies of Malcolm IV were largely characterised by efforts to consolidate royal authority and manage the complexities of Scottish feudal society. Inheriting a kingdom that had seen significant expansion and reform under David I, Malcolm faced the task of upholding these advancements while imprinting his own mark on the governance of the realm, making sure these Norman changes that David brought through would not change and would carry on. One of the key aspects of Malcolm's domestic policy was his approach to land management and royal patronage. He navigated the intricate system of land grants and titles, a crucial element in maintaining the loyalty of the nobility. This was a delicate balance, ensuring the royal grants and favours bolstered his support among the nobles, both Norman and Celtic alike, without undermining the crown's authority. Malcolm also focused on legal reforms and administrative efficiency. Building on the foundations laid by his grandfather, he aimed to strengthen the central administration, ensuring that royal decrees and justice were effectively implemented across the kingdom, and ensuring coins were minted in his name and image. Malcolm's reign also saw a continued interaction with a powerful and often assertive Scottish nobility. Managing these relationships were key to his governance. Now, we will have an episode where we catch up on the nobles, but the nobles like the De Bruce family that were later reconciled, the Balliol family and other Norman families that have been brought into Scotland, they are obviously on Malcolm's side because obviously his grandfather David brought them into power and they can see in Malcolm the potential to gain more land and influence. And the Celtish lords, like the Mormondom of Ross now, have been given land themselves to at least appease them for now. So Malcolm's balancing both sides of the coin that is now the Scottish court, the new Norman aliens, and the... I laugh every time I say the aliens were Normans, but yeah, the alien Norman nobles and the Celtish locals and the lords like the Mormondom of Ross. Regular councils and meetings with the nobility were tools Malcolm used to manage these relationships as well. These gatherings were not only for addressing grievances, but also reaffirming the loyalty and discussing matters of state. He also had to address disputes, handling the aspirations of powerful clans and maintaining a degree of control over the nobles' actions as well. This new feudal society didn't sit well with some of the clans, the local heritage clans in the north. So Malcolm really had to get together and bring a structured direction for his rule. The period of Malcolm IV's reign was not only a radical reforms, but rather consolidating and building upon the existing framework that's been laid out by David I. Much of Malcolm's reformative efforts were in line with continuing the policies initiated by David. This included strengthening the royal administration and continuing the development of the legal system. Now, Malcolm also paid attention to the relationship between that big medieval baddie, the big medieval control, the church. He continued to support the church's role in Scottish society, while ensuring that its influence remained aligned with the interests of the crown. Malcolm IV's reign was predominantly focused on internal stability, while also significantly marked by his approach to foreign relations and diplomacy. His dealing with neighbouring countries, particularly England, were crucial in defining Scotland's place in the broader geopolitical landscape of the time. Malcolm's relationship with England under King Henry II was perhaps the most significant foreign policy aspect of his reign. The historical context of this relationship was complex, rooted in the past conflicts, territorial disputes, and familial ties. Malcolm's approach to England was one of cautious diplomacy, seeking to balance Scotland's independence with the realities of English power and influence. The peace and stability he managed to bring through, especially after what his grandfather David did, especially across the Scottish-English border, were continual points of negotiation and concern, but he succeeded at least in part. Beyond England, Malcolm also navigated relationships with other neighbouring regions, such as the Norse territories in the Isles and Ireland. These relationships were characterised by a mix of diplomacy and, at times, military engagement, as Malcolm sought to assert Scotland's interests in the face of regional power dynamics. One of the most pivotal moments in Malcolm's foreign policy was the signing of the Treaty of Chester in 1157 AD. This treaty was a significant diplomatic agreement between Malcolm and Henry II of England. The Treaty of Chester addressed several key issues, including territorial disputes and recognition of Malcolm's authority over certain regions. While it was a compromise, the treaty was vital in maintaining peace and stability between Scotland and England. The implications of the Treaty of Chester were far-reaching. It reinforced Malcolm's position as a ruler who could negotiate and hold his own in diplomatic matters. But throughout this reign, the pious and frail Malcolm was consistently outfought and outmaneuvered by Henry II, in my opinion. He was crowned King of England in 1154, much to the dismay of many of the Scottish nobles. In 1149, Henry had promised David I he would uphold Scotland's claim to much of northern England. But in 1157, Henry summoned Malcolm to meet him at Chester. The Treaty of Chester. There they signed the Treaty of Chester, under which Malcolm relinquished Scottish claims to Cumberland, Westmoreland, Northumbria and Carlisle. In return, he was granted the Earldom of Huntingdon, arguably his right, by the way, because it was in succession to his father. If you remember, his father was Henry, Earl of Huntingdon. So in reality, he was already due to have this. This was not a good deal by any standards, though perhaps Malcolm judged that his refusal might spark a war with Henry II. With all the resources of Normandy, Aquitaine and England at his disposal, Henry was probably not the best man to go to war with at this time. But giving up Carlisle was especially a sad thing. If you remember, Carlisle was something David I had built up. He'd made sure the town was well supplied, he'd built the town up, built the castle up. He'd made Carlisle a formidable force in the north, and to give that up and all the land that Scotland had over the traditional English-Scottish border was crazy. He had basically relegated Scotland's borders back to before David had taken charge, and that's kind of looked down upon by the chroniclers of the time, and I can see why, because David had done a lot to gain the massive amount of land in England. He got his son recognised as Earl of Huntingdon, but now the only way for, well, Malcolm to be recognised Earl of Huntingdon, which by the way isn't a massive land, was to succeed Cumberland, Westmoreland, Northumbria and Carlisle. And on a bit of a tangent, on his return to Scotland, Malcolm was besieged in Perth Castle by forces under the command of a number of Scottish nobles. Reconciliation was achieved following the intervention of the church, but it should have been clear to Malcolm the Maiden, as he was becoming known, that his dealings with Henry were not popular at home. Malcolm raised further concerns in Scotland when in 1159 he went to France with Henry II of England and supported him in the siege of Toulouse. But we'll cover that in the next episode. All you need to understand is Malcolm has given away large parts of his land in England to Henry II. And let's be honest, Henry II now is the Plantagenet king, the one with all of Aquitaine, the massive amount of English land. It's, you know, known as the Plantagenet Empire. So I understand the hesitation on Malcolm's side, but to give away all that land for something you were already technically going to get anyway, which was the Earl of Huntingdon, it's just, yeah, it was never going to be looked favourably upon the Scottish nobles, especially the Norman ones. Other than that siege, though, there was a few early military challenges for Malcolm to face. One was a revolt in Moray, a region with a history of resistance to the central Scottish authority, just like our old friend Macbeth. Malcolm led a campaign to quell this uprising, which was crucial in asserting his control over a key part of his kingdom. Remember, Moray is now part of the Scottish kingdom, thanks to David, so no wonder this area would flag with rebellion as soon as Malcolm took charge. This campaign was significant not only for its immediate military success, but also for its implications in consolidating Malcolm's rule over the throne, especially over the more distant parts of Scotland as well. Malcolm also led expeditions to northern parts of Scotland, areas that were often on the fringes of central control. These campaigns were aimed at reinforcing royal authority in the regions and deterring potential rebellions, not determining them. If it was to determine, he would probably have quelled them a lot sooner. Malcolm's reign coincided with significant events in England as well, including the conflict between King Henry II and Thomas Becket. Malcolm's involvement in these affairs, although not always direct military actions, demonstrated his engagement in the broader political and military landscape of the British Isles. But as the young boy king, Malcolm's leadership in military matters was a crucial aspect of his development as a ruler. He may have been considered as a frail ruler, but his campaigns in Moray and Northern Scotland were early tests of his military strategy and leadership skills, showing that maybe Malcolm the Maiden wasn't so maiden at all. Malcolm's relationship between the crown and church was a defining element of his governance as well. This period saw Malcolm navigating the complex interplay of the religious influence and the reforms that David had brought through. Malcolm's reign continued the trend of close ties between the Scottish monarchy and the church, a legacy passed down from his grandfather David I. This relationship was crucial as the church was a significant political and social force in medieval Scotland, hence why they were able to get David off the hook. His approach to religious matters and the church was characterised by respect and collaboration, but he was also mindful of maintaining royal authority over ecclesiastical matters. The young king's affiliation with the church was not just a political necessity, it was also a reflection of the period's prevailing belief in the divine right of kings and the church's role in legitimising royal authority. During his reign, Malcolm oversaw several religious reforms and ecclesiastical appointments. These actions were integral to ensuring that the church in Scotland aligned with his vision and grandfather's vision for Scotland. The appointments of bishops and abbots were politically significant. These positions were not only religious, but also carried substantial influence in local and national governance. Malcolm's choices for these roles were strategic, often favouring candidates who were supportive of these policies and sympathetic to the crown's interests. The crown's involvement in religious reforms and appointments underscored the interwoven nature of secular and religious power in medieval Scotland. The church's influence on Malcolm's governance was profound. The ecclesiastical leaders were often key advisors to Malcolm, and they played crucial roles in the royal court. Their counsel was essential in matters ranging from legal disputes to diplomatic relations, like I said earlier. The church also played a role in shaping public opinion and moral standards, which indirectly influenced Malcolm's policies and governance style. As a young ruler, Malcolm was likely mindful of the church's ability to sway public sentiment, which could be critical in times of unrest and discontent. Something we should already look at as well, because I've already mentioned it, is the frailness. Malcolm's health was a matter of concern throughout much of his reign. Chronicles of the time often described him as a very frail man, suffering from illnesses, which seemed to have affected him from a relatively young age. This physical frailty stood in contrast to the demands of medieval kingship, which often required robust health and a strong presence. So nothing like his grandfather David then, or even his father Henry. His health issues impacted his ability to govern effectively at times. Chronic illnesses could have hindered his participation in prolonged military campaigns or extensive travel across the kingdom, essential aspects of medieval rulership. The king's health also played a role in public nobility's perception of his strength as a leader. In a time when monarchs were expected to be physically commanding, Malcolm's illness may have been seen as a sign of weakness, potentially undermining his authority and effectiveness. Combine that with the land he gave away, and that's why Malcolm is called Malcolm the Maiden. In terms of his personal life, Malcolm IV is often noted for his piety and dedication to religious duties, a trait that was likely influenced by his close relationship with the church. Like we mentioned earlier, his devout nature was reflected in his patronage of religious institutions and his involvement in the ecclesiastical matters. Malcolm's character was described as being virtuous and morally upright. These traits were admirable, but also meant that he faced challenges in dealing with the more ruthless aspects of medieval politics and the management of ambitious nobles. The best way to view Malcolm is he was a realistic king. He viewed the current situation. He saw how giant England had become and how strong of a leader under Henry II he was facing. Hence why he gave the land up and didn't want to fight England and suffer more loss of his land. And in that way he could keep his earldom of Huntingdon. But in the same essence, his frailness and his way of giving away land made him viewed less strongly than his grandfather to his nobles. This is something he would still like to try and change the minds of, and it's something we could touch upon in the next episode to see if he succeeds in changing the opinion that he had from the nobles. And in the next episode as well, we'll touch upon what the chroniclers viewed Malcolm as. How did they view Malcolm's rule in Scotland? In my opinion though, with all things considered, he was a boy king. He came to the throne at a very young age and was having to fill the shoes of one of Scotland's greatest rulers at that period of time. So you know what? Malcolm did okay. He still kept the kingdom together, still kept the changes that David had initiated, including all of the Davidonian Revolution and all the Norman lords are still in power. Yes, he lost some land in England, but other than that, he still kept the kingdom strong, it still kept it centralised, and still kept the Kingdom of Scotland together and without much rebellion. Compare that to David's early reign, and you know what? Malcolm appears to be coming off a little bit better than David did, but that's a bit controversial, so I'll leave that there. These challenges and controversies shaped the perception of Malcolm's rule both among his contemporaries and in the historical accounts. His reign is often viewed through the lens of these difficulties, highlighting the complexities and obstacles he faced as a young ruler in a very turbulent period of Scottish history. But as we conclude today's journey through the early to mid-reign of Malcolm IV, it's important to acknowledge the sources that have illuminated our understanding of this period. I've decided to throw this in at the end again because I had some really good comments and feedback of you guys actually really liking me giving the sources at the end, so I'm going to try and do that from now on. Regardless, our exploration was significantly informed by Geoffrey W.S. Barrow's seminal work, Kingship and Unity, Scotland, 1000 to 1306 AD. Which provides an in-depth analysis of Malcolm IV's reign and the broader context of Scottish history, something we've used already in past few episodes. Additionally, Richard Oram's Domination and Lordship, Scotland 1070 to 1230, offered valuable insights into the social and political dynamics of Malcolm's era. Next time, we'll delve into the later years of Malcolm IV's reign and his untimely death, a turning point that paved the way for William the Lion, one of Scotland's longest reigning monarchs. This period in Scottish history is crucial as it sets the stage for significant developments and challenges that the kingdom would face. The Scottish fight for independence. We have an exciting journey ahead with the next 45 episodes planned. I'm not kidding you, 45 episodes I've planned. I think I've planned up to episodes 95. So we've got episodes of the Crusades coming. Just, yeah, tons of cool stuff. So we'll continue to unravel the intricate tapestry of Scotland's past, which is why I've obviously mentioned the Crusades there as well. We want to be delving into the deeper stories of European history whilst we're covering Scotland's history. So that way you can put Scotland's history in the context of everyone around them. But anyway, this episode has gone on long enough, so as always, our podcasts are released weekly with 3 episodes per month, so be sure to tune in for our next episode, where we will bring closure to the story of Malcolm IV and begin the era of William the Lion, a king who could stand the test of David I, and, you heard it right, 6-7 episodes planned for William the Lion. So we're going to have quite a few many episodes to go through, just like we did with David. Anyway, remember you can always join the conversation and stay updated by following us on Twitter at the History of SE1. That is at the History of SE1. or by liking our Facebook page at the History of Scotland podcast. Thank you very much for the recent follows on Twitter and also for the likes on the Facebook page. We're nearly at 50, so thank you. Your engagement and feedback are what make this journey through history so enriching. Thank you for all the recent reviews and comments on the iTunes podcast platform as well. If you've enjoyed today's episode and you haven't yet left a review, please do on your preferred podcasting platform. The reviews help us grow and it helps me improve my content going forward. You can listen to the podcast on various platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Podbean, and many other great podcasting sites. So whether you're at home or on the go or delving into your own historical research, our episodes are readily available for your listening pleasure. I'll be redoing the second or third episode at some point in December. I need to set aside time to it so that way any new listeners don't have to deal with a toaster mic for the first 9 episodes. Anyway, thank you for joining us today. Have a fantastic week ahead, guys. Stay safe, goodbye, and we look forward to bringing you more captivating tales from Scotland's past in our upcoming episodes. Peace, guys.